Hello and welcome to New Books in African Studies. I'm your host, Nicholas Walton. In every programme, we talk about a new book that looks at Africa and hear from the author. In this episode, that book is Exposures, Photography and Africa, and the author is Erin Haney. It's a beautiful and fascinating book that looks at how Africa has been seen from behind a lens over the last couple of centuries. I really enjoyed talking to Erin, and so here's the interview. Okay, well, joining me on the line from Washington, D.C., or just outside Washington, D.C., is Erin Haney, the person behind Exposures, Photography and Africa. Erin, are you there?
Yes, I am. Hi there, Nicholas.
Well, welcome. It's not a normal book that we would do on New Books Network for the simple reason that this is a book mainly about something far, far, far more visual. It's a collection of snapshots. It's a collection of photographs that have been taken in Africa at various points over the last couple of hundred years of all sorts of things. We've got oil platforms. We've got pictures of people in ceremonial dress. We've got pictures of industry. We've got pictures of colonialism. There's all sorts going on here. And I just wondered, what's the kind of idea behind the book?
No, it's a really good question. I'm coming at it from the perspective of somebody who's interested, first and foremost, sort of in photography, and the fact that the sort of perceived ideas about how photography has unfolded in the world has sort of had its centers in Europe and the United States. And being somebody who's studied Africa for quite a while and who's lived there, I was interested in showing images from the sort of whole range of the photographic past in Africa to give a sense of the breadth of practice that was happening there, really beyond the colonial sort of presence, because this is the sort of understood frame is that Africans sort of snatched the camera from the hands of colonizers and sort of ran away with it, and that maybe only happened in the 1950s. And of course, by doing a work like this, you get a sense of, you know, that photography happened really instantly, nearly. And it happened around the world. And so by 1840s, we have people that are working on the West African coast and in Cairo and in, you know, sort of South Africa and all sorts of places. And so I think that surprises a lot of people, and it sort of deepens our understanding of, you know, the vision of Africa that a lot of us unfortunately have, which is, you know, Hollywood and National Geographic. Mm-hmm. And it's very limiting. So I wanted to sort of bring that out. So,
well, I think you succeed. It's a beautiful book and a fascinating one, especially for anyone who's even vaguely interested in any of the many aspects of Africa that it covers. Of course, it's a bit of a challenge for us because you're over in Washington, I'm here in London, and right, we've got to be able to describe what's going on in the books, in the photographs that we're choosing, to people who cannot see the book. But anyway, I'll probably bump the microphone quite a few times leafing through. But before we even get to that, why don't you just tell us a little bit about yourself?
Okay. I've been working in Africa since 1993, so sort of quite a long time. I was there originally as a visiting undergrad. I went to school at McAllister in Minnesota, and I had spent a lot of time with African students and realized that my knowledge of the continent was woefully lacking. Our American educational system doesn't really live up to the global history idea as much as one might like. And so I just thought, well, I better head over and sort of see what was happening. So I spent time in Kenya. And then after I graduated, I went and lived in Accra, Ghana, for a long time and sort of went back and forth. And then, started a master's and a PhD in African studies and art history at Northwestern University in Chicago, and then finally made my way to SOAS there in London, and where I worked with John Picton and really just decided to immerse myself, fully in this idea of what were the sort of histories of photography. And I was interested in Accra because I'd spent a long time there, but, you know, as I started working, I realized between the riches of photographic sort of legacies, the colonial sort of in institutions that are there in London and other parts of the UK, as well as in France and in Switzerland and all these other places, you know, that there was a lot there, and very few people had really looked at it and tried to think about the history. They were captivated by the images. There were lots of people who were thinking about the images, but weren't really thinking about the larger sort of sense of what was happening. So, you know, the seduction of the images is one thing, but I think the stories behind them, you know, for an art historian and for somebody who's interested in thinking about them beyond the idea, the frame of reference of the museum or a coffee table book, is what I wanted to try and get at by talking to lots of people, that it was very clear that there were intense stories there, and that, you know, photography has, you know, a serious history and a serious meaning for lots and lots of people. It's very valuable. And, you know, and that it's moving around a lot. So it's very hard to sort of, you know, it's a politicized sort of subject, I think, right now, especially. So
how did you choose the photographs that are in the book? Because, I mean, you've got, what is it, 180 pages or so. You've got, how many photographs are in here? About 100. There's such a variation. There's such a range in the types of a photograph, the subjects, the times when they're taken, etc. Right. When I first looked at it, I wondered how you'd actually gone and sifted through everything out there to choose these ones.
Yeah, no, it's very difficult. I had spent a lot of time, you know, digging through sort of West African archival material. And then here in D.C. at the Smithsonian, which is where I ended up doing some more research at the National Museum of African Art, there are quite a large photographic archive here. And a lot of the images, or I would say maybe a fifth of the images in the collection are in the book, are taken from that collection, which covers much of the African continent and has quite a lot of historical depth to it. But, I mean, really, there are images sort of from all over the place, from Middle Eastern collections, from family collections on the continent, from photographers who are maybe American or European who've worked on the continent a lot. And I really did just want to get at the range of material, not to say that this is a comprehensive sort of overview of practice that's happened there, but really just to spur people's interest so that for those who know nothing about it, you know, it will really give a tantalizing sort of taste of what, you know, the breadth of practice that's happened, but also for people who are interested in studying it more or used to thinking about sort of African creative practice as a, you know, as more textiles or painting or, you know, sculpture, things like this, that there is an interesting sort of cross fertilization of image making that happens, and photography has always been part of that. So, but I did want to avoid sort of the typical war journalism. I did want to avoid the sort of Hollywood National Geographic kinds of imagery, and so there are, you know, very deliberate sort of turning towards certain subjects and moving away from other ones that I feel like have been, you know.
Well, the variety certainly works for me. Let's start with the photograph that you've got on the page opposite your introduction, and that's the I'll read out what the title is. It's Deck Passengers on an African Steamer, 1890 to 1900. And we'll just start off by talking about what's in the photograph itself. Basically, you've got a section of a steamer at sea somewhere, and they look as though there's probably 2 to 3 dozen people gathered there in amongst all of the clanking machinery. You've got people up on a guardrail above. They look as though they're dressed slightly better, and they're looking down at people who are no doubt in some form of steerage class or whatever. Can you tell us a little bit more about what's going on here?
Sure. I mean, I think what's happening is this is a steamer off the coast of West Africa. It could be by, you know, any of those big port cities, Lagos, Accra, Cape Coast. What is happening in the image to me that's interesting is one that a photographer wanted to. We don't know who the identity of the photographer was, but he wanted to, you know, capture the sense of travel and mobility that was happening really from the 1850s. All along Africa's coast. And so, you know, we have here, you know, people that are very well dressed that could, you know, could be coming from England, could be coming, you know, headed down to South Africa. There are sailors, there are laborers, there are people who could be clergy members or sort of, working with missionaries or with schools. We need to remember at this time too, there was an African sort of intelligentsia that was coming around, and you know, people were being sent to Europe all the time to go to school. So it sort of just gives us a glimpse of the sort of different groups of people that were moving around, and that travel was sort of relatively easy and cheap as these things go. And so people could easily go from Accra to Lagos or to Freetown and Monrovia, mm-hmm. up to Liverpool. You know, and it was an investment, but it was something that people could fairly easily do. And that this mobility is actually part of a long strand of people who've been migrating back and forth. And mm-hmm. of course, people were going across the land too, but the sea travel really rose around the time of the advent of photography and became very easy and sort of manageable because of that rise of the steamship trade.
I see this photograph as fitting in very nicely with this picture a little bit further on in the book, which is a plate-laying gang shifting camp on the Uganda Railway, and that's a decade or so later on. And again, this is another photograph of something that it's about as far away from a studio-posed shot as it would be possible to get. It's a 3, 4, 5 railway carriage absolutely covered with gangs of what look actually like Indian or subcontinental labourers, obviously shifting camp. But again, it's all about this new forms of transport, new forms of outside intrusion, finding their way in and mobility, etc. And big themes like this. What I like about this is it really shows the power of a photograph to be able to capture something that it's very easy to read about in the book. And this is obviously the entrance of the grand entrance of the European powers into Africa. And here you actually see a proper representation of what it was actually like on the ground.
Right, exactly. And, you know, and that those forms of travel and movement are quite different. I mean, this was about indentured laborers, you know, coming over from India, which, you know, was very common in the 19th century, coming over to East Africa and sort of building the colonial infrastructure of the railways and the creation of cities like Nairobi. Mm-hmm. And in other places, which this conscripted labor and the sort of economic conditions are very different in different parts of Africa. And I hope that those images in the book also give that sense that, you know, we can't really talk about Africa as one place where everything happened and unfolded in the same way in each place, that the conditions are quite different in each place.
Mm. Let's turn now to page 29, where there's a self-portrait by one of these pioneers of this new technology, photography, who's actually bringing us all of these amazing images. And there's lots and lots and lots from around this time, towards the end of the 19th century. Can you tell us a little bit about this chap, Gerhard? You said that there was a way of pronouncing this. Lutterot?
Right, Larry. Gerhard Lutterot was one of the pioneers, at least, of photography, certainly in the Gold Coast, what's now Ghana. He was from a big trading family with a Danish sort of ancestor and very high-born sort of merchant families that were based in Accra. And so we have this guy sort of taking a picture, which is quite late. He started working in the 1870s, and he moved, as you know, photographers tended to do back then, you know, no matter where they were in the world. There was a sense that people did need to migrate continuously to keep things together, you know, that there were only a certain number of patrons that were able to pay for, a portrait at that time, and they were quite expensive. So people kept moving around, and he was one of them. He moved, you know, from Freetown. He mentions going, you know, to Accra and to Fernando Po, this island sort of south of mm-hmm. the coast of Lagos in Cameroon now. And it's possible that he also went down as far south as Angola. So he certainly plied the trade of the West African coast and all of the cities there. He certainly also, we know that some of his brothers were educated in England and went back and forth. So they were part of this sort of intelligentsia and merchant class that had means. And he and several of his brothers, actually, and then nephews, also set up studios all along in Nigeria, in Fernando Po, in Ghana. And his story is really interesting. I managed to talk to a number of his descendants who also, you know, this sort of dynasty of photographers, the Lutterot family, we're working certainly in Ghana from 1870 to around 1940, just before the World War II. So, you know, it's a tremendous amount of time of expansive operations and things that they saw. And, they did lots of other things too. They moved people around, as West Africans migrated all around for work and for labor, sort of supporting the colonial administration and its projects, working as its soldiers. So he was one of the people who sort of organized and oversaw the movement of people, as well as documenting during his own travels, the changes in the landscape, the changes to cities as they were happening. Mm-hmm. And portraits wherever anybody would like. And it wasn't simply a matter of photographing European colonials that were there. You know, of course, anybody who had means, whether they were sort of, people of local authority or royalty or, the sort of rising merchant people or soldiers. We have a surprising diversity of subjects that he took, that Gerhard Luttrell took. And he's very much remembered as such, as a pioneer. And is an extremely important figure within the family that still reside in Accra today.
And I think it's worth saying that he also takes a splendid photograph of himself. He looks like he's a very handsome man. He's got a splendid big mustache. He's wearing a very, very handsome little tailored suit, a bow tie. He's got what looks like some kind of almost leopard skin cap on his head, although I can't really make that out. And he's leaning against quite an ornate piece of furniture. It's a lovely photograph.
It is, and you'll notice too that he actually has a horse whip in his hands.
I was trying to work that out.
Was really, really, probably sort of an elite practice, but happened in Lagos and Accra and in Freetown and sort of all over the place, and people would gather for these horse races. So in the photographs that he and other photographers took, we see spectators, decked out and sort of attending these horse races and looking on, and it was a big business. So yeah, there he is, sort of enfolding everything in that self-portrait.
He probably used that to sell his expertise as well, I imagine.
Exactly. I mean, here he is, the
his
quintessential cosmopolitan. Exactly. He's the quintessential well-traveled, beautifully dressed cosmopolitan, self-assured and ready to go anywhere, take your portrait and transform you into one of those people.
Absolutely. Beautifully dressed, but dressed in a very Western style. It's got to be noted. And then later on in the book, obviously, there are lots and lots of photographs, which are snapshots of customs, modes of dress, etc., that some of them no doubt are lost now. There's a remarkable photograph about halfway through the book, and that is, the title is A Girl Before the Fattening Process, and this is in Nigeria, southern Nigeria, and she's been painted in chalk, and she's quite chubby around the middle. Can you explain what's going on here?
As far as we can tell, and I'm sure there are people that could even sort of talk about this with more authority, but I'm interested in this photograph of this girl. She's standing in front of a very beautiful, elaborate painted backdrop, with sort of Victorian curtains and wall moldings and the things. Her whole entire body is covered with chalk, and she's got this beautiful straw girdle wrapped around her waist, which she's holding. Her face has been beautifully adorned with sort of tracery of chalk. And then she's got this incredible coiffure of, looped braids and hair with all sorts of ornaments in her hair. And then she's holding a fan that you see in any sort of 1880s, 1890s picture of, of Victorian life. Sort of wherever you go, you would see these little folded round paper fans. So there she is, and she's presenting herself for the camera, and probably her family commissioned this photograph to mark the entrance of her going into this process where girls of a certain age, maybe it's before puberty, it might be around puberty, but anyway, a lot of places, there's a time in which girls are sort of taken off into seclusion, and they're educated in all the ways of how to be a woman, and they, it's sort of the big step between childhood and adulthood. And of course, this is a time where the family has to lavish lots and lots of expense on the sort of upkeep and maintenance and the education of the girls at this time. And part of it is the public presentation of these girls at certain moments within this sort of initiation process, you could say. And the public debut, of which this might be a sort of final image or an image of something, you know, just one stage that was happening. What we see here is part of what would have been a public performance where the girl was sort of unveiled in all of her finery. And this was a sort of proclamation that she's come through to the other side. And we have this all over the place. But the fact that cameras were being called upon to document this, and that this was considered, you know, a very high point at which you could photograph a young girl and make a portrait of a young girl or a young woman, as it were, is really interesting. The fact that that comes through quite easily for a certain urban patronage early on, and then also that it became folded into a postcard that was published. You know, so we see here photographers taking these beautiful images that were meant for private, that were originally privately commissioned, and then they enter into a larger sort of realm of images that are sent around and sort of give us a sense, outsiders a sense of what was going on in Africa, but become very exoticized and, you know, take on a very different tone than would have been, you know, certainly the case for the family. Mm-hmm. And the local people who were seeing this image and seeing this sort of sight of her.
Yeah, it's remarkable how it's been made into a postcard. There was another thing that I actually wanted to ask you about, and it kind of follows on from this point. It's actually on the next page, and it's about a celebrated African lecturer called Jacob C. Haisley. And it's got a front and a back to it. It's got this, again, a very, very dignified portrait of the man himself dressed in Western clothes. But it says that this is a carte de visite. Sorry, my French has never been a strong point. So what was this used for? Was this a way that people could actually hand over a document saying, well, this is me, this is where I come from, this is what I've done?
Mm-hmm, exactly right. He was, my guess is that this very detailed biography that he puts on the back, we don't often see this on carte de visite. We often see just a name or maybe a name and an address. But he has very carefully sort of turned this into a little, you know, mini CV, as it were, you know, listing his experience, his travels all over Africa, the grand personages with which he worked. And he came over probably... for the United States Centennial Exposition, which happened in Philadelphia in 1876. And so he was very cleverly showing his credentials and saying, I am not an American. I am a West African. Mm-hmm. I come from Sierra Leone, and I've put all of my experiences out there as a lecturer and as a writer and a traveler so that anybody can see where I am and where I'm coming from, because, of course, the presumption that he was, you know, that he imagined that he was going to contend with, in particular with American audiences, I should think, was very different. And so he was sort of trying to market himself in a certain way by having this beautiful portrait and a very detailed biography. I think it's a rare carte de visite because it doesn't, we don't often see that kind of detail, but I think it's a really interesting, sort of object that gives a sense of people moving out in the wider world and having, a set of expectations that, of who they're going to be, that they need to defy right at the beginning by showing the breadth of their education and experience. So,
well, you say it's a bit like a curriculum vitae or something. It's a bit like a personal website or something. I mean, what it actually does is something that we all still need to do today, and that is find a way of getting your credentials across, etc. So it's a remarkable way of doing that. And he does seem to have traveled quite a lot. I'll just read out the first couple of lines of it, just so that people get an idea of it. And this is on the back of this card, which starts off with a big picture of him, and it says, Jacob C. Haseley, the celebrated African lecturer. And then on this second side, this dense text saying, Jacob C. Haseley was born at Freetown, Sierra Leone, West Africa, September the 17th, 1835. He was the second son of Jacob Boston and Elizabeth Haseley, his grandfather. And then it just keeps on going. It's quite remarkable. It tells you when he went up which river and when he traveled across to the United States, as you said. I really, really, really enjoyed that. There's a much more modern portrait that I wanted to also move on to. And this is taking us 50 years forward, 60 years forward to 1952 to 55. And this is a portrait, much more modern one, of a gentleman that just looks astonishingly stylish and dignified. He's got a he's looking off into the middle distance. He's got a very, very handsome visage on his face. He's wearing a very sharp suit. His collar on his shirt is perfectly positioned, sticking out across the collar on his jacket. He's got a lovely big handkerchief sticking out of his pocket. He's got a ring and a watch, and he's holding a pair of shades quite delicately in his hand. This is a very, very different view of Africa. And of course, this is the 1950s. This was a very confident time for Africa as well.
Mm-hmm. No, exactly. And it's by, as you know, as we can see, the renowned photographer, Seydou Keita, a Bamako-based photographer who worked from the sort of late 40s through to the 60s and carried on a private practice after that. But had a studio practice and then also worked as a government photographer. And Keita's studio and other studios in Bamako were known because that was the sort of center of a major railroad crossways in West Africa, a bit further north, well away from the coastline. And, so there were all sorts of people coming through that place, through Bamako as a hub all of the time. And Keita's studio was known as a place where you should go and get your photograph taken. So, of course, this was a time when people were dressing, people had been dressing in European dress as they could afford it and as they chose to for, hundreds of years. And so maybe it's surprising to see this, but we also see a lot of Keita's images, women dressed in full boubous with incredibly elaborate sort of jewelry and hairstyles and everything else. So to see Keita's studio is to see lots and lots of all different kinds of people coming through, and how they position themselves in front of the photographer's camera is really interesting. But Keita was a master of tilting the camera just so, and prided himself on getting the sort of the beautiful essence and the surfaces of his subjects, how he posed them, how he dressed and arranged them, and of course how they arranged themselves too. We're all part of the story, and his photographs are so powerful to us today because they were huge black and white glass negatives that he used, and so the images are very clear and stunningly sort of complex and with these beautiful tones from all the way from dark shady blacks all the way to these crisp whites of his collar, and the way he lit his subjects and everything else. With sort of minimal, basic, camera equipment and natural light and things like that, are stunning. And they've really captured a lot of attention, particularly in the West. There have been exhibitions of Seydou Keita's work, and they really are all portraits. And they're just, astonishing surprises for those of us who may not know the sort of range of which people, how people were looking and how people were dressing themselves. But you also mentioned the 1950s, this was the rise of, really, strong, nationalist sentiment and, the idea that really independence was coming quite soon to places like Mali and Senegal and Cote d'Ivoire, Ghana, Cote d'Ivoire, Nigeria. All over the place, there was a really big sense of, that the end of colonialism was near. And so the confidence, like you said, the idea that there was going to be self-rule soon and how we're repositioning ourselves within a larger world, all of this comes out in photographs like this.
Absolutely. I think that the main thing that comes out with the confidence is the way he's standing, or the way he's sitting, rather, and the whole confident pose, the way he's looking forward into a future, and sort of there's a slight little half smile on his face that I find quite enchanting. And also when you're talking about the detail, you can see the skin tones, you can see the individual warp and weave of the suit that he's wearing. I think it really is an astonishingly handsome picture. I think it bears up next to anything that you'd see into in a magazine these days.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
after this, there's quite a large section of the book that really goes back to more colonial times. You've got lots of, you know, for instance, in the Belgian Congo, you've got lots of pictures of African soldiers standing with their little blue uniforms, barefoot and holding rifles. You've got lots of pictures of ivory caravans, camel bearers, etc. in the interior. Was photography in that time, I know that we're going back in time slightly, was photography a way of almost advertising colonial life and colonial achievements for European powers?
Oh, of course, certainly. It was a huge part of it. And you know, it's an unavoidable part of the story. It's absolutely crucial to understanding a more complex idea of what colonialism was, because, you know, we see these images of, you know, wealth, essentially wealth in rubber, in ivory, in gold, and in palm oil being taken out, and the sort of infrastructure that was being built. Of course, this was conceived of in the case of King Leopold and, you know, and this area as his own private fiefdom. And so he, you know, all of this extraction of wealth went towards, you know, the personal enrichment of the city and of his own sort of private coffers. Mm. So, you know, there's a massive amount of exploitation that's sort of behind the scenes in imagery such as this. And it gets masked when we look at these photographs of, you know, very orderly people standing in queues with their ivory, as if it's all, you know, a very agreed upon process. And of course it wasn't. Mm-hmm. And so photographers took great pains, along with, you know, sort of collaborating with soldiers and merchants and the sort of forces that were at play, in order to, you know, coerce people into labor, into doing these extraordinary things. And of course, you know, if you know the whole story of King Leopold and the extraordinary, mm-hmm. You know, atrocities that took place under that regime and sorts of all different parts of Africa, but that was an extraordinarily terrible era for it. So the picturing of colonial extraction of wealth in Africa is a huge theme, and we see it all over the place in lots of different parts of Africa. We see ivory carried out, you know, sort of in force, you know, coming to these factories. We see images of atrocity that are happening by people who weren't, you know, allied with the sort of commercial interests. So there is actually a quite complex picture of the situation and marking how colonialism affected people. You know, we see the victims of atrocities, you know, under King Leopold's regime. And then we see this sort of orderly rise of cities, of electrification, you know, the building of infrastructure. And, you know, this the sort of underlying framework to that is that imagery of people civilizing and taming what they thought of as a wild landscape, you know. And once that this was done, you know, the wealth could be taken out and could be used. And hope, and the idea was, you know, maybe in certain cases Africans themselves would benefit from it. But I think it was pretty clear for a lot of places that Europe was the main beneficiaries of it. I mean, we see London and Brussels in the landscape of those cities, and it's certainly built on that extractive labor that happened in the 19th and early 20th centuries.
There's a terribly sad photograph on page 100, and this is in keeping with what we've just been saying about the Congo. And it's a very pared down photograph. There isn't any of the kind of color and complexity that you see in some of the other photographs in the book, but it's a very sad, thoughtful looking man sat in the foreground, and he's looking at a couple of fairly indistinct objects, it's got to be said. And then there's just a bit of countryside, a couple of palm trees, a road with a figure on the right hand side behind him. And this is from 1904, and it's only when I read the accompanying little label that I realized what it was. And it's the title is Nsala of Wala, with the severed hand and foot of his five-year-old daughter, who was murdered by the ABIR militia. And that's what those two indistinct objects are. And it's quite horrible. That's the foot and the hand of his five-year-old daughter.
Right. No, the thing is that Alice Harris, the photographer, the British photographer, and her husband, who were there sort of documenting these atrocities, were part of a large campaign, a human sort of human rights campaign that really got its start in the UK. There were African-American proponents of this. There were sort of people all over the place who were on the ground documenting the atrocities under King Leopold's regime. And so images like Alice Harris's are incredibly important for really the truth-telling capacity of photography here to shock and stun viewers who were overseas, because, of course, this would have been perhaps a commonplace scene if you were living there. But, you know, for people in Europe who could have done something and could have protested, as they did eventually, King Leopold's, the practices that were in place, the soldiers and the sort of rule of force and the sort of reign of terror that happened there, you know, all for the sake of extracting material and goods and sort of treating Africans as if they were not human. This kind of photograph completely eviscerates all of those arguments and makes it very, very clear that, you know, people needed to act. And so, it, you know, it's, you know, 1904, it's a very early example of the use of photography to get across, you know, a very vivid social commentary.
So while the authorities are using photography to show just how bountiful the produce is in the Congo and just how civilized it is now that they're able to recruit locals as soldiers, etc., you've also got this kind of counter campaign, again using photography as a way to really bring the immediacy of the problem there to people in places like London to get campaigns against Leopold's rule there. It's astonishing.
Right.
Astonishing. A bit further on in the book, we have a much more modern picture that tells us a lot more about, shall we say, some of the more modern problems that Africa has faced. Perhaps not so much up to date now, but we're talking about the 1980s. We're talking about South Africa, still deep in apartheid. And it's a picture of a woman who's the teacher in front of a class of 80 young children. Who are peering out behind her. It's beautifully composed. It's not set up in the way that you'd imagine. She's kind of sitting back against her desk. She's got a headscarf on, and she's got a really pleasant smile and, you know, almost a curious smile. And behind her is this enormous wealth of lovely little faces. Some of them, one of them's holding up a pair of what look like slightly oversized spectacles above his head. And it just gives you a picture of what life was like for the African underclass in South Africa at that time.
No, exactly. This is 1983. It's a picture by Omar Badshah. And, you know, there were in South Africa at this time lots and lots of photographers who were considering their mission to photograph all the aspects of South African life under apartheid. And, you know, because photography's power to sort of suggest and evoke these, you know, these political realities, because even in South Africa, in the cities, the white sort of upper, you know, the sort of ruling class would not have had access to these, to even sort of seeing these kinds of images or seeing these realities for people. So, you know, the photograph of the classroom, you know, with absolutely no desks in it except for the teachers, you know, a few slates among this group of 80 kids, you know, which are sort of ranging in age, you don't even get a sense of how sort of barricaded and segmented life was in South Africa until you... I don't know, you can either read the histories or you talk to the photographers themselves who were saying, you know, there was such a sense of censorship that happened under the apartheid government. So we didn't even know what was happening in our country at the time, unless you managed to get out and sort of break the laws in order to see these kinds of things, what was happening in the prisons, in the hospitals, you know. And so the effort of photographers to not only capture these images, but, you know, as much as they could, get them out of the country and get them into larger journalistic circles, you know, disseminate them around the world. This was all part of that struggle of, you know, loosening the strictures of the government, which eventually did collapse, of course, you know, about 10 years later. So images like this, you know, just sort of subtly documenting the average everyday life and the way that people just got on with things despite all of this, but the shocking inequalities that happened there. I mean, there are a lot of, at least for us in the United States, a lot of similarities with just the sort of straight documentary photography of the civil rights era and what was going on in the South. And the sort of segregation that happened there as well. It's an extremely moving image for me.
Mm. And it's one of several from that period. You've got pictures of a squatter camp just outside Cape Town. There's a remarkable photograph on the next page. And this is obviously migrant workers in Joburg. So this must be the mining migrant workers, and they're gathered around a communal stove, and all of the little concrete beds, well, they just look like shelves to start off with, don't they? They look like somewhere where you just I don't know, dump a bag of potatoes and walk away, and these are actually the place where they sleep, the beds. There's also a white woman at a shooting range. Obviously this is when security became a big concern for the white population. You've got a domestic worker in Johannesburg staring with a very, very wistful look outside the kitchen window as she's doing some washing up. And then the last one on this particular section is a black woman stood outside a grocery store that is absolutely stocked full of produce. This is 1986. And she's just got a very big banner hung around her neck saying in big letters, "We starve in rural areas." I mean, this was a very fruitful period for photojournalism, wasn't it?
Absolutely. And you know, even the photographers who were working then didn't necessarily even see themselves, all of them at least, as photojournalists. They were documenting the everyday realities, and they saw themselves as activists and as, you know, cultural workers whose mission it was to document, record, make art about, make songs about, write about, everything about this political system, because the disinformation, you know, that sort of held that system in place was astonishing and so pervasive. So at the same time, you know, you talk to the photographers now and you see that sense of, or you hear about that sense of people with placards, people making graffiti on the walls and things like that, you know, that there was a very visible sense of people trying to disrupt in any way they could, those systems of, the doors for the white people to go in and the doors for the colored and black people to go in, you know, that sort of system that sort of played out on everyday, you know, streets and in everyday scenes. And, you know, the way in which people were resisting and fighting that in every way that they could, not only people who were coming into the cities illegally because they weren't allowed, they didn't have the passports, they didn't have the legal right to come into those cities, except to be working, you know, as domestic people or working in shops and homes. So we see these sort of bits of defiance everywhere, especially in the 80s. And people, you know, took their lives into their hands by making these sorts of protests.
Mm, it's remarkable stuff. And then finally, the last photograph, and obviously listeners have got to understand how many were skipping over, just how many incredible photographs were skipping over. But there's one that, this one we were talking about a tiny bit beforehand. It's taken in the Niger Delta. And it's, I really don't know what to make of it. Is it a good photograph? Is it not a good photograph? I don't know. It's the top of what looks like some kind of gas or oil extraction platform. It's got the letters Bonga, B-O-N-G-A, written in the foreground. I suppose the colours are quite remarkable, quite beautiful. There's a lot of blue in this, the sky, and then the lights from the different bits of mechanics on the platform itself. Can you tell me what's going on here? And do you actually think that this is a good photograph?
I think it's a good question. I think it's an extraordinary photograph. I don't believe that a photograph has to. I don't think that a photograph has to paint a picture or give us a sense of the picturesque. At the same time, it is an incredibly vivid and beautiful photograph. We have these sort of soaring clouds, and then we have this mysterious light happening on this oil platform. This photograph by Babajide Adeniyi Jones, taken in 2005, you know, when he told me about it, he said, this oil platform, the tidiness, the clearness, the few people that are working there, the sort of sparse, orderly sort of picture that we see here. You know, there's no dirt, there's no grime, there are no sort of laboring masses. It's the opposite, it's the antithesis, you could say, of the kind of government that it's supporting. Here we are over here in Lagos, we've got, you know, millions and millions of people coming to this megacity. We have, you know, astonishing wealth and astonishing poverty. And above all, we have this chaos, you know, the chaos of the government, the massive inequalities that are happening, you know, with the Niger Delta, and the way in which the money is sort of being siphoned off, and where, you know, where's the money for the people who it's supposed to be benefiting? We have this chaotic system here. And then yet here on the Bonga oil platform, there's nothing but sort of orderly tidiness. So that contrast only, you know, it can't necessarily come out in the photograph. You have to understand the sort of story around it. And hopefully when you start to look at this photograph, it draws you in and makes you wonder what is going on here. So for that reason, I think it is an extremely powerful moment, but it's not something that gives away the whole story itself. You know, it doesn't unfold within the photograph. And I think that's true for a lot of important imagery from Africa. There's just so little that we, you know, maybe living in the United States or in Europe, even know about the political realities and what's happening there. And by putting these out and giving a platform and realizing that there's actually a lot more around it, there's a whole photographic narrative, and there's a whole sort of personal and political and social narrative that's sort of surrounding these in clouds. And we can't look at this without imagining that that's happening elsewhere. And it's understood when we look at photographs, I think, in the United States, you know, but we're slowly understanding that wherever it is, you know, whether it's China, where, you know, it's South America, wherever it's happening, there's a larger story that's being told. And I think that photograph of the Bonga oil platform, by drawing you in with its intense and sort of lush colors, you know, makes you wonder and draws you in and then gets you thinking about what is actually happening there.
Okay, I'm sold.
Great.
I now agree with you. You've explained yourself very well, but you've not just explained that. I think what you've done there is you've probably explained why this book works overall, because you know, we're talking about the actual photographs themselves, and we have to, especially when we're doing this and it's an audio interview. But accompanying all of the photographs, of course, there is an enormous amount of explanation from you. So I think that's why the book works so well. I suppose that's enough about the book just for now. I just wanted to finish up the interview and just ask you if I mean, you lived in West Africa for quite a while. It sounds though you've traveled around quite a lot as well. Do you have a favorite place in Africa?
I do, definitely. Well, I have a couple. Accra in Ghana, the capital city of Ghana. I spent a lot of time. I have, you know, really a second family there. It's a lovely, old, beautiful city. It's full of chaos and traffic, and it's sprawling and dense along with everything else. And people are completely relaxed, friendly. The food is just ridiculously lush, complicated, beautiful, and fantastic. And my friends that are there are just some of the most interesting people, generous, thoughtful, and provocative group of people to have conversations with, and I love them and I miss them, and they also have an amazing salsa scene, or at least they did when I was last there. So you can always go and have fun in Accra.
Okay, and you said that there were two. Was there
another actually,
one?
Well, actually, I like Cotonou a bit too, which is a city on the coast in Benin, not too far away. You just take a taxi or you drive over there and get, and you can also have a beautiful time wandering around the city, meeting people, hanging out, and enjoying the sun and the surf. But to me, the most interesting thing is the people that you meet and the relationships that you form. So
fantastic. Well, Erin, thank you so much indeed for this. As I said at the beginning, I wondered how it would work doing a book about photography, but two things. One, I haven't banged the microphone too much as I was leafing through the book. And the second, I hope that we have actually managed to get a bit of a flavour of what the photographs look like. There's so many here, and it's so difficult to approach it. But I hope we've succeeded.
I hope so, too. Thank you so much, Nicholas. It was really a pleasure talking to you.
And that was my interview with Erin Haney, the author of Exposures, Photography and Africa, one that I thoroughly recommend that you track down if you're interested in either Africa or photography. This is Nicholas Walton from the New Books Network, wishing you a good day from here in London.